Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today is podcast number 115 for Wednesday, March 7th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone. With me today is Baggy the Cat as a co-host. She's climbing around underneath my desk and strongly considering attacking the cables that go to the microphone. And I'm bringing that up because Baggy, sometime, I think day before yesterday, I'm not sure exactly, the day is kind of blend together lately, but anyway, she made her way into my office and decided to begin pulling things off the walls. I have blankets on the walls and hanging from the ceiling in order to dampen noise and give a little bit better sound with less exterior noises coming through. So she decided that she would just rearrange the office a bit. So it looks like she bounced up onto the desk and jumped up on top of the some of the blankets that were attached to the walls, and they were attached by way of, I had some with twine screwed into the walls, and then the blankets hung over the twine, and others with paracord screwed into the walls, and then the things hung over the paracord. Well, she went after the twine, which, who knows, she might have tried the paracord too, and it may have survived, but the twine didn't survive, and so down came the blankets. And so now she's sitting in great satisfaction on a pile of blankets and microphone cables in the floor looking at me. So that's the update on Baggy for today. All right, so now I've got a couple things I wanted to go over. One thing that I wanted to touch right off the bat is something my friend Jock Coates reminded me of in Facebook. Jock is... He is a warden at Oxford Brookes University and a former staff elected governor of the university and academic board member. And he is in Oxford, UK. And so now that you're all impressed by his titles, he's a pretty cool guy, actually. Anyway, he reminded me on Facebook that the early Christians had to redefine marriage since it was reserved for citizens of Rome. Slaves and non-citizens were not sanctioned for marriage. It was against the law. It was against the government's wishes for non-citizens to have a government-sanctioned wedding. Now, now that's the way it was in most of the empire. In Palestine, since that was a separate kingdom, even though it was a province of Rome, it was still considered a separate sovereign kingdom under King Herod. For Christians living in, say, any of the other, in the Bible, Paul writes to Corinthians, and he writes to the Ephesians, and he writes to all these other mostly Greek-based cities that were in the Roman Empire. And the communications that he would have had during his time, during the time of Paul, would have been to people who were, if they were not Roman citizens, then they were not legitimately married according to the state. And I bring this up because so often Christians forget that when you beg the state to define marriage, and when you place into the hands of the state the authority to tell you what marriage is and what marriage is not, well, that might be real convenient now, today, when the state is defining marriage the way you want it to be defined. But just keep in mind, at some point in time, other people get in charge of the state, and then they can redefine that same marriage in any way that they want. And then it's law. And this is the problem with trusting the state to define what is and what isn't morals and what is and what isn't socially acceptable. When you voluntarily place that into the hands of the state, you're taking it out of the hands of individuals, out of the hands of free individuals, you're asking the state to become what the clergy and what morals and what the community and what, and in the Christian belief, what God has sanctioned. You're throwing all that away and you're putting it into the hands of the state. You're literally trusting Rome. Okay, that was just a side note. I didn't really want to make a big deal out of that, But generally, when Jock Coates speaks, I try to pay attention and see what he has to say, because he's a pretty interesting person. Today, what I really wanted to talk about, I wanted to touch on a few things. I've got some pretty extensive notes here, and I'll try not to be too mechanical with them. I'm trying to get back into the flow of podcasting, and get my head wrapped back around it. And so, in doing so, I tried to give myself some fairly specific notes so that I could keep my mind focused. And so if it sounds too mechanical, I apologize. I'm going to try to get through these notes as much as possible without allowing myself to wander off into Never Never Land, which is what I've tended to do here recently. I wanted to cover, first off, the difference between government and state. This is something I've had a lot of requests about, and this is something I've talked about quite a bit. And it's something that I think the liberty movement in general has a lot of confusion about. And even some of the notable writers, I read things that Murray Rothbard has written, or, a lot of others. I don't want to pick on Murray. That was just the first name that popped into mind. But I've read a lot of things that a lot of other liberty writers have written. And, I don't see the clarity that I'd like to see in this differentiation, between the government and the state. So I wanted to give this definition again, just to kind of try to say it in a different way and clarify it a bit. The government is made up of people who are employed and supported by taxation and the use of aggression to maintain their monopoly of power. The state, on the other hand, is the myth that such things are legitimate. So now let me just reread that again. The government is made up of people who are employed and supported by taxation and use aggression to maintain their monopoly of power. But the state is the myth that such a thing is legitimate. Okay? Now the government is not the problem. The myth is the problem. So it's real easy for libertarians, or it's real easy for anarcho-capitalists, or it's real easy to attack the government and say the government's the problem, the government's the problem. Well, the government is your neighbor. The government is your family members. The government is just people trying to do a job. It's just people doing stuff. This is real often what comes up with the problem with the police issue, with the problem of cop bashing. Or it's so easy to be distracted and think that the problem is the cop, or to think that the problem is the cops or the police, when in fact the problem is the state. The problem is not the individual cop, and the problem is not even the actions of the cop. And to attack the cop or to attack police, whether verbally or, in any other way, you're doing exactly what the state wants you to do. This is the same for any level of government. To attack the government and say the government is evil, it's doing this, the government is evil doing that, the military is bad, we have to, tell what horrible things the military does, and we have to point out these terrible things. No, you're missing the point again. It's not the government that is bad. It is the concept. It is the myth. It is the religion. It's the superstition that the existence of the state is just and good. When you get past that, when you can grasp the concept that it's the state which is evil, then without the myth, the employees of the government would be held responsible for their actions, just like every other group of people. Without that myth, other agencies, other organizations would spring up to compete with what we call the existing government. And the current government would simply be a poor choice in the market. Like all other things on earth, it would adapt to its competition, or else it would die out. I mean, you think about it, like, how many Tyrannosauruses do you see around? But we sure do see a lot of alligators if you go to the right place. So you see the two, and you say, well, one was able to shift or move or adapt, and the other was not. And so one is here and the other is not. And this is the same with government. You can't defeat government, or you can't improve government. You can't do anything at all to make the situation better as long as you believe the myth of the state, the myth that it's okay for individuals who are sanctioned by this religious society for them to act in ways that no one else in society can act. As long as you're believing that, then you're believing the theology of the state. You're accepting the state as God, and therefore whatever that the government ends up doing is already sanctioned. It's already holy. You've already made that decision. So to complain about the government without realizing that it's the myth of the state that's the problem. I put together one of these pictures, you know, with the words on it that you do in Photoshop. I don't know what the official terminology for those things are, because it's technically not a Photoshop. A Photoshop is where, like, you take, one person's body in another person's head and you put them in a comedic situation or whatever. But I did a picture in Photoshop where I took a picture of the White House and I superimposed a dragon's face behind it. And I said, as the caption I put, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. It's who's behind the White House that counts. And my point in that being, you know, not that there's some group or some secret society manipulating the White House, or not that there's some, you know, some a theory like that. That's not the point of that picture. The point is the dragon, the mythology, the beast is that religious belief that when the government acts, when employees of the government, when representatives of the government act in ways that we wouldn't accept in under any other circumstances, when we believe that that's okay, we're accepting the state, we're accepting the myth of the state. And as long as you're accepting that, you can't deal with the government. And when you kill that myth in your mind and you eliminate the possibility of the myth and you kill the state in your own mind, once we all begin to do that, then at that point, competing agencies can develop. There are competing agencies today. And as this takes place, then the government will become a dinosaur. It'll become a useless thing. We'll know. And now this doesn't contradict my other statements about how the state will have to come to its whole maturity. The state will, before it can ever fall, the state will have to come to a complete maturity. And now let's make one more distinction here. There's a lot of confusion about the U.S. government and whether or not the U.S. government will eventually someday fall. Well, of course it will, but that's not the state. That's just one government. The U.S. government will have to either fall, or it'll have to be absorbed into a larger government, or it will have to absorb other governments, or in some way the U.S. government will have to morph into something different than what it is right now, because it's not financially supportable right now. It's not sustainable. So it's going to continue to change itself, and it may collapse, or it may, just absorb Canada and Mexico and become a large North American thing, or it may become a Western Hemisphere thing, or it may become a NATO thing, or it may be a United Nations thing. But however it morphs in the future, in order to keep itself going, or if it collapses completely, none of these things matter, because this is just government we're talking about. The bigger thing is that myth, the myth of the state. And the myth of the state is worldwide. Now, the government is not worldwide yet, but at some point, if you follow through the logic on this, the myth of the state has got to become universal, and the governments have to become universal at some point in time. It may be in some type of an Orwellian situation where it's divided into two or three or four geographic regions so that there's constantly fighting so that they can use that as a way to control people. Or it may be some other form. But one way or the other, we're looking at a global domination that the state has to mature to before it can fall. And that's still generations away, as I've said before. Okay, now let's... we've got dogs barking, so we may have to pause. Okay, so that was just Django howling because he could hear a siren in the background. Okay, so let's... I kind of wandered a little bit from my notes there, so let me try to get back to my notes a little. See, now that's the reason I made notes, so that I wouldn't wander, and then what do? I end up wandering from my notes. Okay, so now here's a question. Is law fixed or is law arbitrary? Now, how we think of this can change, and then how consistently we examine how we think about this can alter how we think about the state and how we think about libertarianism and anarchy and the whole question. Is law fixed or is law arbitrary? If law is fixed, it must be applied consistently, otherwise it becomes arbitrary. Now, Hans Hermann Hoppe has said that the state is the ultimate arbitrator in every case of conflict, including conflicts involving the state. So can legitimate justice be produced when there is such a conflict of interest? So, for example, the idea that the state is here to sort of keep the peace among people that's the typical reason people say you have to have a state-based government, is so that it can keep the peace by being an arbitrator between conflicting parties. And without the state as the arbitrator between conflicting parties, then everybody would just be at perpetual war with one another. But as he points out, the problem with that is at some point in time, somebody is going to have a problem of some kind with the government itself. And if a state-based government holds a monopoly on aggression and a monopoly on law and a monopoly on justice, then you're asking that same government to be the arbitrator between you and the government. And so would we accept this kind of a conflict of interest under any other circumstances? If you had, let's go back to apples and tacos again, shall we? Let's say you ran an apple stand, and another guy runs a taco stand, and you make an arrangement with him. Hey, you know what? I'm getting tired of eating apples. How about for lunch today we swap, and I'll give you an apple, you give me a taco. And so the taco dude's like, that's a good idea to me. I'm getting tired of tacos all every day. And so when lunchtime rolls around and you both get done with the heavy part of your shift, and you take a break for a second to kind of refresh yourself, and you pick up an apple and you walk over to the taco guy stand, and you're like, hey, dude, here's that apple. Can I get a taco from you? And the guy reaches out and takes the apple, takes a big bite, and looks at you and says, no, I don't think so. Now you've got a problem with him. Well, this is where we need an arbitrator. Now, at this point, we can just out of nowhere magically believe that we have to have a guy with a gun who's going to enforce himself upon us. Or we can believe that the two of us, the apple vendor and the taco vendor, can hire, or in some way get a volunteer perhaps, and have an arbitrator under voluntary circumstances. We have these two choices. But what if it wasn't those choices? What if the choice was the taco vendor is the arbitrator? He is the ultimate arbitrator on everything. Well, now you're standing there, you're like, dude, you took my apple, you promised me a taco. And he says, too bad, what are you going to do, sue me? And you're like, okay, yeah, I want to sue you for a taco because you promised me a taco. And so the taco vendor says, all right, case is now being heard, the apple vendor against the taco vendor, and make your case, Mr. Apple Vendor. And you say, you promised me a taco, and I gave you my apple, and you took the apple, and you didn't give me a taco. And the taco vendor says, I find in favor of the taco vendor, case dismissed. And so what are you going to do? Well, nobody would accept that kind of a situation as a legitimate form of justice. And yet that's what we do with the state. if you're going to address some kind of grievance against the government, who decides that? Does a committee of your neighbors get together and decide, you know what, the government was wrong in invading, XYZ countries, and so we want all of our taxes back that went to pulverize the cities in those countries? Do you think the people in Washington, D.C. would recognize that? Of course they wouldn't. And why wouldn't they? Because the government in Washington, D.C., as far as the United States is concerned, is the ultimate arbitrator in all cases, including cases against the government in Washington, D.C. And it's the same way in London and Paris and in every other capital around the world. You accept the myth of the state, and when you do, along with it comes the idea that this most blatant and obvious conflict of interest is okay, it's acceptable, it's good, we're going to go with that. So that brings us back to the same question again. Is the law fixed or is the law arbitrary? If the law is fixed, then how is it that one arbitrator has a complete monopoly on establishing what is law and how that law applies and to who it applies? How is it, if the law is actually fixed, that we can arbitrarily put it into the hands of one party and assume that it will always be, that it will always follow that law? And then, again, practical experience proves that it doesn't. When the Supreme Court says one thing, when one court says one thing and another court says another thing and another court says another thing, all on the same question, and it finally goes to the Supreme Court, and then we have some justices saying one thing and another justice saying another thing, and it ends up with essentially a democratic choice between how many justices on the Supreme Court believe one way and how many believe another way. So ultimately, law then is decided in an entirely arbitrary manner among a collection of justices on the Supreme Court. That's in the United States anyway. Therefore, law is not fixed in the United States. Law is arbitrary because it's based on the temporary appointments of who is on the Supreme Court, who is in Congress and who writes the laws, who is in the presidency and who inflicts the laws upon us, and who is in the Supreme Court and translates these laws. It's entirely arbitrary. Now, if law is arbitrary, then in a sense, you see, there's this argument that we can't have anarchy, because if you have anarchy, everybody will just be making up their own laws. There won't be any fixed law. One guy will say, hey, it's the law for me to kill you. And another guy will say, hey, it's the law for me to steal your apples. Well, that's a straw man argument. That is not actually what anarchy would be like, but that's the straw man argument that gets thrown at us. But actually, the argument that under anarchy law would be arbitrary, well, as I've just now said, under the current system, law is arbitrary. It's based on the temporary appointments. It's based on the opinions of people who are in temporary appointments and their ability to get a majority vote on their side of the issue. So one generation might say gun ownership is a right, and another generation might say, well, it's kind of a right, and another generation might say it's sort of a right, and another generation might say it's not a right at all. So law under a state and justice under a state is entirely arbitrary. But as we'll see in a minute, law under anarchy is fixed. Let's break for a minute and have one of our wonderful commercials. How would you like to support badquaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. All right, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And again, I'm going to try this week. I don't know if I'll get to accomplish it or not. But I'm going to try to record some new commercials so you don't have to hear that same one every day. Okay, now, what I was just talking about before the commercial break was the question, is law fixed or is law arbitrary? And as we were seeing, if law is arbitrary, therefore it's given to the whims of men, then government is already the type of anarchy that statists fear, where the strongest strongman rules. That's one of the arguments given against anarchy, that you can't have anarchy. If you had anarchy, then just whoever's the strongest would be in charge of everything. Whoever's the richest would be in charge of everything, and everybody else would bow to them. But isn't that kind of what we have right now? Isn't the case right now where law is arbitrary and whoever can get in charge of the state is the strongest strongman and inflicts their will and their translation of law down upon us? And it may not be one individual person, but it's a collection of people under the guise of the state that function as a government. And their arbitrary decisions are placed upon the rest of us as law. That's the system we have right now. That's what anarchists are accused of. But in fact, that's what the state actually provides now. Now, there's another argument that will always be thrown at anarchists. And I call that the invading state argument. The idea is, you can't, if you had anarchy, then you might have it here for a little while, but eventually some other country would come and they would attack you and they would invade you and they would do these things. And eventually you'd be under the foot of some other state. And, that it's actually, in ways, it's a strong argument. But here's the problem with the invading state argument. If indeed anarchy is a more preferred situation and the existence of a state is a less preferred situation, then should fear of a state mean that we should have a state to keep from having another state invade? Now, okay, so applying this logic under different circumstances, let's say I'm afraid my car is going to get stolen. Let's say I'm afraid a car thief is going to come and steal my car. So would a solution to that be to take my car and give it to a car thief? Should I give my car to a car thief in order to keep my car from being stolen? So if I'm afraid of an invading state coming and destroying my anarchy, should the solution be for me to have a state so that a state can invade? I mean, this is kind of an odd type of circular reasoning that we fall into with this. But the real problem is that this question assumes that the state will always be. Now, this is part of a trap of thinking where the statist believes the state to be omnipresent. It's always been, and it will always be, in all places and in all times. This is, it's blasphemy to a Christian. It should be blasphemy to even to the atheist. But this idea that the state has always been and will always be is the root of the problem in the question of the invading state. We're assuming that when anarchy is the rule of the day in, let's say, North America, when there is no government utilizing the state, dominating North America, we're assuming that there's going to be a government dominating, using a state to dominate with in some other part of the world. And so if we all here in North America decide we're going to have anarchy and we're not going to have a state functioning under the guise of we're not going to have a government functioning under the guise of the state, and we're going to have anarchy, that suddenly somebody else, the Chinese or the Russians or whoever, Kenya, somebody's going to invade us. And so because of that, we need to have the state. We need to have a powerful state, a state big enough that we can beat them constantly so that they don't invade us. This is kind of the frame of thinking there. But that assumes that there's always going to be a state, and that's where the flaw comes in. Now, the thing to keep in mind here is the state had an origin. The state had a birth. There was a time when there was no state, and then there became a state. This happened when a human accepted the notion that it was right for another human to make and enforce laws upon them. So before that took place, there was no state. When humans decided that it was okay for other humans to make up laws and enforce those laws upon them, when that took place, there was a state. But when humans decide that it's not right for a small set of humans to make up laws and enforce it upon them, there will be no state. Not just in North America, or not just in my community, or not just in one little area, but there will be no state. This was the problem in the 1800s, before the United States government really had a chance to branch out, and before the tentacles of the state could really reach out across the prairie and really infect the land of North America. There were a lot of small, independent, anarchical groups that moved out and formed sometimes communes, sometimes towns, sometimes different types of organizations. And they would form in different places throughout the prairie and throughout North America. And they were relatively anarchical and relatively free. But as the state expanded out, and it became more than just the United States in name only, and the real concept that the state was in control of everything, as that infected North America, then all these, one at a time, these little anarchical communities had to be absorbed, and true statism had to take over. So you see that happening throughout the West, as each little independent community suddenly had to give up its local judges and give up its local law enforcement that were entirely a part of the community, and they had to bow their knee to the incoming authority of the state as it moved in on them. But when the time comes that the state reaches its entire maturity and collapses, it's going to be dead. It's that Tyrannosaurus, and we're going to be the alligator. We're going to still be around, but the state is not going to be. There's no possible way a Tyrannosaurus can now rise up and threaten an alligator. It's just not a possibility because it's dead. And when the state, I mentioned, let me look at my notes here. Did I say that earlier? Without the myth of the state, other agencies could spring up to compete with the existing government, and the current government would simply be a poor choice in the market. And like all other things on Earth, it would either adapt and compete, or it would die out. So I don't know if I got to that part of my notes earlier or not, or if I just skipped over it. But either way, that's the situation that we're going towards, where eventually, if the government is going to compete, once the myth of the state dies away, if the governments are going to compete, then they're going to have to adapt. But they can't as long as they try to live under the notion that that some people have the right to inflict their will upon others, utilizing aggression like that. Okay, so let's see if I can catch back up to my notes here. All right, so I was talking about the state had an origin. The state had a birth. At some point in time, humans accepted the notion that it was right for another human to create and enforce laws upon them. So at what point did that take place? Well, I've talked about Jericho before, but Jericho, even though it was the first city-state that we know of, it was the first proto-state that we know of, the concept of the state was not born there. The first functioning state that we know of was born there. But the concept of the state started earlier. Now, if we go into the realm of religious thought, and you don't have to be a Christian or you don't have to even be a theist to believe this, if you can just work on the theory that it had to start somewhere. Let's assume, for argument's sake, let's assume that all aspects of evolution are true, and some type of early humanoid was grunting around doing whatever it was that they did, and at some point one decided that he could dominate the others. Now, not just in a way that, oh, like an alpha male or an alpha female will dominate a pride of lions, or the way an alpha will dominate a pack of wolves or something like that. Because at any point, any of those wolves can simply walk away from that pack. You see, they can choose to challenge that alpha at any moment, or they can choose to just leave the pack. So that's different from the state. That's leadership. And that kind of leadership is entirely acceptable to the anarchist. But that's not the state. But at some point, assuming all the evolutionary theory is correct, at some point in time, some early human had to grasp in his mind the idea that, you know, that guy over there, whatever he says is the law, really is the law. And for some reason, we're going to believe that whatever he decides is the law is going to be good, and he can enforce it any way he sees. Now, that kind of sounds pretty goofy, but at some point in time, humankind had to accept that notion, and that was the birth of the state. So now, coming at this from a theological point of view, we do have stories. Within all of humanity, there are these creation stories. And you don't have to accept them word for word to understand what I'm trying to get out here. But let's assume that you do. Now, we just assume the evolutionary story to be true. Let's assume the biblical story for a moment. Let's take the Garden of Eden. Now, I want to point out something first about the Garden of Eden, and the Christians might not like what I'm about to say. You ready? The Bible doesn't say the Garden of Eden was perfect. It doesn't say it. Go read it for yourself. Read every pick up a concordance. Do you have a concordance? If you're a Christian, you need a concordance. Something like Strong's makes a good concordance. Strong's exhaustive concordance of the Bible. Pick one of those up. They're probably about $20. I don't know. I haven't priced one in a long time, but you pick up a concordance and you look up and you find every single mention in the Bible of Eden and read every one. And you, if you actually read it and you read the context and you read the actual text, you will see that nowhere in the Bible does it say that Eden was perfect. It says it was well. If you take apart the Hebrew language and you examine what the wording of the Hebrew language actually says, Eden was well watered. It had a good water supply. But it never indicates anywhere in the text that it was perfect. You could fall down and bruise your knee in a biblical Eden. You could fall off a cliff and get killed. There's nothing in the scripture that indicates that if you fell off a cliff in Eden and cracked your head open on a rock, that you would simply walk around with your head cracked open. It doesn't say anything like that. It doesn't say that if you sat on a bee in Eden, that the bee wouldn't sting you. It doesn't say that. Nowhere in the scripture, nowhere in the text does it indicate that Eden was perfect. It only says that Eden didn't have sin. And so now, wait a minute. How can it be that there was no sin there? Well, then we have to ask what sin is. And we have to ask, what changed? How did sin get introduced? What's the difference between whether it's there or whether it's not there? Let's just look at this for a moment. Sin was introduced with the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Take all the stuff in your mind about apples. Oh, there's a commercial on television currently where they're pawning pomegranate juice off on you, and they try to infer two different things. They try to infer that pomegranate juice is an aphrodisiac, and they also try to infer that somehow the pomegranate was the original fruit from the Garden of Eden. Of course, that's entirely made up. There is absolutely nothing to support that in any way, but they're selling you a product. The same thing goes with the apple. There's absolutely nothing in scripture that indicates in any way that there were apples at the time. As a matter of fact, we know that the apple is a relatively new hybrid. It could not have existed at the time. So if you get the nonsense out of your head that you're taught in Sunday school and you're taught by television, you're taught by movies, and you're taught by all these other people who are selling you something, you get all that nonsense out of your head and you really read the scripture and you see what the text actually says. The tree was the knowledge of good and evil, the ability to judge between what is good and what is evil. What was the first evidence that man changed, that sin became introduced? No, it wasn't that they died. That's in there, but that's not what happened. The very first thing where you could see a change of what happened before and what happened after was that they noticed they were naked. They noticed each other as being naked, and they attempted to hide their nakedness from each other. Now, for some reason, this leaps into people's mind. Oh, yeah, yeah. Now I know what the fruit was. Oh, yeah. No, you couldn't miss the point by more if you tried. Think about it. Before they indulged in the fruit, walking around naked was normal. After they indulged in the fruit, walking around naked was bad. But in whose eyes? Because according to the scripture, God comes into the garden and says, "Where are you guys at?" And they're hiding from God. And they said, "We're over here. We're hiding." And he says, "Why are you hiding?" And they said, "Well, because we're naked and we're embarrassed." And God says, "Who told you you were naked? You see, who's the judge here? Is God the judge? because God didn't judge them naked before. Who judged them and decided they were naked? They judged them. They decided they were naked. Humans created a law. Humans created a law that had never existed before. And then they wanted to inflict it upon themselves. Now let's think about the timeline of events in Eden. If you go through and you read the scripture, the timeline of events goes like this. God made everything. God made all the stuff. And then the last thing God made was the people. And it says, male and female created he them. And the first thing he told them to do was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, just for all you dirty-minded people who think that fruit was something that it wasn't, do you think God was stupid? Do you think God was so stupid that he would tell them to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, but he didn't know how they'd do it? Do you think that God is such a sadistic, evil jerk that he would tell them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, but you can't do it like this? Do you think that makes any sense? No. Here's what makes sense. God created them, and just like all the other animals, it was within their natural urges to reproduce, and they began doing it immediately. Because what else are you going to do once your belly gets full? So they were reproducing. They did reproduce. For a long time they reproduced. How long? We don't know how long. How long were they in that state prior to the taking of the fruit? We don't know. A day? 2 days? 6 weeks? 14 weeks? 26 weeks? 200 billion years? We don't know. There is nothing in Scripture that indicates the time frame, how long it took from the time God said, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, to the point of where he said, hey, by the way, don't touch the fruit of that tree over there. And they went over and took it anyway. There's no indication of that time frame. So I'm sorry for everybody who wants to grasp that the earth is exactly 6,000 years old and da 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 da. Count again. Go back through there. Don't think of the theology you've been taught. Don't think of what's been pounded into your brain. Just go and read the scripture itself. And you'll see that when the time, from the time that God said, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, to what's considered the fall, the eating of the fruit, there is not the slightest indication of a time frame between those two. So it may have been sheer moments, mere moments, or it could have been eons of time. And to arbitrarily just place a time frame on that is reading something into the scripture that's not there. So I'm not going to say it was a week or a day or a month or a year or 10 billion years. I'm not going to say. Because I wasn't there, and it's not in the scripture, therefore, why would I assume? But I can assume that if God told them to be fruitful and multiply, that had nothing to do with the tree that they were not supposed to touch. So then, what was this sin? What changed from the time that they were without the sin until the time that they noticed that they were naked and they had sin? What changed? Did God change? Did God's laws change? The only thing that changed was the law. There was a new law. You can't be naked. And who decided this law? The same people who took the fruit. The ones who took the fruit decided you can't be naked anymore. God shows up and he's like, hey, what's going on? And they're like, we're naked. And he's like, wasn't a problem yesterday. Who decided that this is a problem now? And get your mind past the sensationalism that they were naked. That's not the point. The point was they made up their own law. They became the lawmaker. Humans took themselves and placed themselves as a god, as a lawmaker. Now, you can using the terminology of the founding fathers, so-called, of the United States, when they said nature's God, and they use that terminology in the Declaration of Independence, nature's God. Okay, so let's take the atheist position, let's take the agnostic position, and let's assume that we don't know who God is or what God is or if there's a God or if there's no God. And we assume that the laws of nature exist so that, a bat can fly and a rat cannot, because it's within the nature of the bat to fly and it's within the nature of the rat. If he jumps off of a cliff, he's going to fall, because that's within the rules that govern their species. So within nature's law for humankind, it was okay to be naked. And then one day man decided it was against that law, or man decided that mankind could not be naked, and he made up a new law. And again, don't be confused by the sensationalism of, because it's, we're talking about naked. The point is not whether or not you have clothes. The point is that man has created a law that is no longer nature's law. It's no longer a law of nature's God. Man has placed himself into the position of lawmaker, and man is now the judge. Man is now the law. Man is now God. And that is the knowledge of good and evil. When man makes up that knowledge, when man arbitrarily creates law and then inflicts it upon other men, that is taking man and placing him in the position of God. And that's what we have. We have arbitrary law. We have arbitrary law made up by humans and inflicted upon their fellow humans, because we believe the myth that men can make up laws and inflict them upon their fellow humans. So then, is real law fixed or arbitrary? With man, it's law, it's arbitrary. But God's law, that law of nature, that law is fixed. What did Jesus say about the law? When they came to him and they said, what is the greatest of all the commandments? And Jesus said to them, look, here's the deal. All of the law and all of the prophets can be summed up in this one thing. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, every Jew who heard that in the day realized exactly what he meant, because the Old Testament was made up of three parts. It was made up of the law, the songs, and the prophets. And so Jesus said in that statement, the law and the prophets are all summed up in this one thing. And he laid out the golden rule. And I've already covered how the golden rule is essentially the flip side of the coin that is the zero aggression principle. And so that's the law. That's God's law. Anything above and beyond that, or a modification of that, is man taking God's law, taking nature's law, and adjusting it and creating his own, putting himself in the position of God. So then, now we have to go back and readdress this question. Anarchy and the strongest of the strong men. This is one of the arguments against anarchy. Well, won't the strongest of the strong men just get bigger and bigger and stronger and take over everything? Won't the richest of the rich just take over everything? And of course, like I pointed out a minute ago, well, that's what we have right now. But let me go back to quoting Hans Hermann Hoppe for a minute. He says, well, the state is always and everywhere eager to disarm the population and thus rob it of an essential means of self-defense. Private law societies are characterized by an unrestricted right to self-defense, and hence by widespread private weapon ownership. And I butchered that pretty bad, so let me read that again. Hans Hermann Hoppe says, while the state is always and everywhere eager to disarm the population and thus rob it of an essential means of self-defense, private law societies are characterized by an unrestricted right to self-defense and hence a widespread private weapon ownership. As in the argument of the invading state, under the current system, we have the strongest strongman. After all, isn't the President of the United States regularly called the most powerful man in the world? And that's the reason why is because he controls the largest, most powerful fighting force that the world has ever known. So the system we have now is the system that they say, oh, you can't have anarchy because you just have the biggest and strongest of the strongmen would be chief in charge of everybody. That's what we have now. That's not anarchy. That's what we have now. The system that we have now. And the logical direction that it will have to go at some point in time is when there is one source of power worldwide, one president or whatever you might want to call him of the entire world. That's the logical result of where the state will have to go to. So the real question then, well, let's go back to this again. The strongest is the strongman and the argument of the invading state. They're both nullified when the state itself dies. Once there is no state, then no strongest of the strongman can rise up because he won't have the power of the state. And the, and once the state dies, really, the state completely dies. It's like that Tyrannosaurus. He can't rise back up again because he's extinct. He's gone. He's dead. So once the state is gone, there won't be an invading state, and there won't be a strongest of the strongman. Once the true nature of the state is revealed in its completeness, humanity will reject the state forever. This is why we have to allow the state to mature, come to its complete maturity, and die. Now the moral question here, let me check my time, make sure we have time for the moral question. Ooh, I have to hurry if we're going to do it. I'll read it really quick. It's been said by others that during the time of slavery in the U.S., many slave owners questioned how large-scale productions of things like cotton could happen without slaves. Would tolerating slavery due to the lack of imagination of the slaveholders be moral? One can, you know what, I'm going to reread that whole section. Okay, let me read my notes here, what I have for the final moral question. It's been said by others that during the time of slavery in the U.S., many slave owners questioned how large-scale production of things like cotton could happen without slaves. Now, would tolerating slavery due to the lack of imagination of the slaveholders be moral? One can rephrase the question. If you had an old man who had supported himself through pickpocketing since he was a child, and he knew no other way of providing food for his family, would his pickpocketing be tolerated simply because he lacks another profession or the imagination or the motivation to acquire another profession? Should we tolerate his pickpocketing? Of course not. And neither should we except that the state is a necessity simply because it is, simply because it's been going on already for a long time. The moral question of the state is, does one group of human beings have the moral right to inflict their will by the use of aggression onto all other human beings? That's the real question. Not how. Not how can we get out of it? How can we get around it? How can we fix it? How can we improve it? None of those things. None of those things are the question. The question is the state moral? For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thanks, folks, for listening. Thank you very much.